Chapter 17 concludes that high priestly prayer that Jesus prayed. After teaching his disciples in the upper room, after talking to them about the Father, he talked then to the Father about them. Always a good formula. After talking to people about God, talk to God about those people. After he preached, he prayed. And John 17 is a powerful presentation of what prayer is really to be. He probably offered that prayer in the temple. Having left the upper room, moving towards the Mount of Olives, in which he will enter the garden called Gethsemane, he and his disciples probably stopped in the temple area and he offered this prayer in that place. For during Passover, the temple was open all night, the courtyards. Hundreds of thousands of pilgrims came into the city and they kept the temple courtyards open 24 hours a day. How I wish we could do that here. I've often talked to our staff about that. How can we keep the sanctuary and the facilities open 24 hours a day so people who desire to pray can just come down here and find a place to just seek the Lord? It's too bad we live in a society that there are people that just go around destroying for the sake of destruction. Now we have to keep things so often under lock and key. That's sad to me. I look forward to when the Lord comes back and those things will be no more. My sister Nikki and Larry were over for Christmas afternoon with us. And of course, Nikki and I always talk to Mom and Dad about the advantages of living in Southern Oregon. How that, you know, you just... My folks live in Southern California, Riverside County. And so we say, come up here, man, we don't even have a key to our house. It's just open, I mean, you know. And Nikki and I are always telling Mom the environment up here is so much superior. Well, Nikki showed up on Christmas Day and said, Johnny, guess what happened? Last night on Christmas Eve, somebody came in and took our presents from underneath the tree. We were getting up and we went downstairs to where the tree was and started to pass out the gifts, and we realized, hey, there's a whole lot of stuff missing. So, kind of sad that we no longer have as crime-free an environment as perhaps we did 15 years ago. Although I'm not convinced that it's not the old parent trick. Hey kids, we had a lot more presents, really, but a robber came in last night. The old "a robber came in" trick. That's... No. But the temple was kept open, and Jesus probably offered that prayer on the Mount of the Temple. And then after he finished John chapter 17's high priestly prayer, after he had spoken these words, verse 1 of chapter 18, he went forth with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where was a garden into which he entered and his disciples. Leaving the area of the temple, he goes down the side of that small valley. The bottom of that valley, there flowed a brook, a small river called the Kidron. The Kidron, its name means murky or dark. Jesus, at this time, crossing over the Kidron, I wonder if he wasn't deeply touched by what was below him. You see, as he crosses over the Kidron, at this time the Kidron is murky, dark. for the blood of the sacrifices that were offered there on the Temple Mount would flow down to that creek below and cause the water to become very bloody. A mixture of water and blood, and that's why it was called the Kidron, which means dark or murky, because the blood flowed down from the Temple Mount into that creek. And believe me, there was a lot of blood flowing. For thousands of sacrifices would be made during this time. In fact, Josephus tells us that in a census that the Romans took some 20 years later, the census that they took, wanting to know how many people were in Jerusalem, the Jews wouldn't allow people to be counted directly. Why? You might recall what happened to David when David numbered the people. How there was a great punishment inflicted upon the nation because David numbered the people to see how strong he was. In reality, their strength was to be in God, not in the number of their nation or army. So the numbering of the people was something which brought about a real bummer in their history. From that time on, the Jews were very careful to not number people. They wouldn't count. Even today, if you go into an Orthodox Jewish home and suppose they're having a party in which they must number the people for a game, they'll say something like this: not one, not two, not three, not four, not five, not six. And that way they're not numbering, you see. Truly, they seek to get around that numbering any way they can. And so when Josephus wrote of this time when the Romans wanted to know how many people were in Jerusalem, they could only do it by counting the sacrifices, the sheep that were offered during the Passover, because the Jews wouldn't let them number the people. Josephus tells us during that counting of the sheep, 256,000 sheep were counted that were sacrificed. Now, according to the Jewish laws and traditions, one sheep was offered for a minimum of 10 people. Therefore, there must have been at least 2.56 million people packed into the city of Jerusalem during that particular Passover. That would be a minimal kind of number. Could have been significantly larger. Can you imagine the blood that would be produced from 256,000 sheep being slaughtered? The blood flowing down from the Temple Mount area into the creek below where it was mixed with the water. I wonder what Jesus thought when he stepped over that creek and saw blood and water mingled together. He would know within a few short hours that blood and water would flow from his side when a spear was thrust therein by a Roman soldier as he was pinned to that cross. Blood and water would gush out. The blood of those sacrificed lambs all spoke of the blood that the sacrificial lamb, Jesus Christ, would shed. I wonder if his mind went back to how David, centuries previously, crossed over that same brook called Kidron when there was a rebellion launched against him. You recall the story. Absalom launched a rebellion against his father David and sought to overthrow him, and David left. David fled the city, crossing over the Kidron, we are told in 2 Samuel chapter 15. I wonder if Jesus was perhaps reflecting on that. Even as David was driven out of the city, rejected by the people in Jerusalem, so too they will reject me. We will not have this man rule over us. Away with him. The blood and water must have been a real reminder to him. He crosses over the brook. He goes up the side of that hill called the Mount of Olives. It's a hill, really. And there on the side of the Mount of Olives were many, many private gardens. When the rich folks, the well-to-do people in Jerusalem, wanted to get out of the city, they would go down that little valley, cross the creek, and up to the side of the Mount of Olives, where they had enclosed gardens, walled-in gardens. Jesus obviously had access to one of those closed-in, walled-in gardens. Somebody gave him access to their private garden, and that garden was called Gethsemane, which means oil press. A place where obviously olive trees grew and where the olives were gathered and they were crushed by a press in order to produce oil. Jesus in that spot, Gethsemane, which means oil press, would be crushed. When he submitted to the will of the Father, and so heavy was that pressure that the Bible tells us he sweat great drops of blood, saying, "Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me, this cup of suffering. Nevertheless," he said, "not my will, but thy will be done." They're in the garden, gang. Jesus Christ, whom Paul calls the last Adam, submitted to the Father's will. Interesting, because in another garden called Eden, the first Adam rebelled against the Father's will. In the Garden of Eden, Adam ate of the one tree that God said, "Don't eat from it." You know, Adam bombed out and did just that. But now here in another garden, it's not so much a rebellion against God as did Adam, but now the last Adam is submitting to God, saying, "Thy will be done." In the first garden, the Garden of Eden, Adam hid from God. In this second garden, the last Adam, Jesus Christ, comes to pray to God. In the first garden, the Garden of Eden, man was driven out because of his sin. In this second garden, the last Adam, Jesus Christ, comes in to prepare his soul to die for sin. In that first garden, the Garden of Eden, after man was driven out, there was an angel placed with a flaming sword to keep man out. A sword was unsheathed. In this second garden, the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus told Peter, "Put away your sword. Sheath it." Peter put it up. Interesting parallels and contrasts. The Garden of Eden, the Garden of Gethsemane, for what reason? Revelation 22, Bible students. So that we can enter into the garden of paradise that is prepared for us in heaven. Where there's a crystal river flowing and trees that bear forth fruit, 12 different kinds, and it's for the healing of people. Ha ha. Talk about a garden party. It's going to be fabulous. No weeds grow therein. What was lost in Eden will be found in paradise, Revelation chapter 22, in that coming garden, because Jesus Christ went through this garden called Gethsemane, where he submitted to the Father's plan. Our hero, our leader, Jesus Christ, enters into that garden. He begins to pray and submit to the will of the Father completely. Well, he goes therein with his disciples. Now Judas also, we are told, which betrayed him, knew the place, for Jesus oftentimes resorted there with his disciples. Judas, about to betray him, knows where he can find Jesus in Jesus' time of trouble. He knows that Jesus will not be found at the Sandpiper, in the lounge, tipping a few. He knows that Jesus is not going to be found on the couch, watching TV, zoning out. He knows that Jesus will be found in the place of prayer. Judas knew exactly where he would be. Do people know where you would go, where you would be, when there are troublesome times, difficult days? Would your wife or husband or mother or father, if they knew that you were going through difficult days, would they say, I know where he'll be. I know where she'll be. Would they say, at church, in prayer, studying the scriptures? Or would they say, somewhere else? Incredible that Judas knew exactly where Jesus would resort to. He'll go to that garden that we went to frequently to pray. That's where he'll be. And so Judas, which betrayed him, knew where he would be. So he received, verse 3, a band of men and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees. He took with him a band of men. Now, that word, a band of men, it speaks of a cohort, which is one-tenth of a legion. A legion is 6,000 soldiers. Judas here has with him then a contingency of one-tenth of that number, 600 soldiers. I mean, think about that. Here's the Lamb of God, and Judas brings 600 soldiers, besides those from the chief priests, the officers in that contingency, and they came with lanterns and torches and weapons. It was a full moon, Passover. What would be the need of torches and lanterns? No doubt they were thinking, he'll be hiding in the bushes. And who knows what ambush the disciples will set for us. We'll need 600 soldiers and we'll need lanterns. He'll be hiding. We'll search him out. What a shock it must have been. Jesus, therefore, verse 4, knowing all the things that should come upon him, went out and said, whom seek ye? I mean, here they are with torches and lanterns. Where's he going to be hiding? Where's the ambush going to be happening? And they come and Jesus goes out and meets them. Hey guys, who are you looking for? See, Jesus is in absolute control of this whole scene. Don't buy into Jesus Christ Superstar or Cecil B. DeMille or whatever Hollywood might suggest. It's not like Jesus is caught off guard and isn't sure what's coming down. The whole thing, hey, he's in control of. So he cruises out to meet them. Who are you looking for? And they answered, Jesus of Nazareth. And he said, I am. The word he is in italics. It's not there in the original. Just I am, ego eimi, I am. Again, it's that declaration of deity. I am. I am that I am. God identified himself to Moses. And here Jesus is using that same phrase of deity. I am. When they heard that, as soon as he said that, verse 6, they went backwards and fell to the ground. Boom! 600! With their torches falling and their armor and swords clinking. Boom! They're out. Talk about being slain in the spirit. I mean, these guys are out. Now, at this point, Jesus could have walked away and say, see you later. But as they're picking themselves up, wondering what hit them, the force of Jesus' words, the power of that proclamation, I am. As they picked themselves up, Jesus didn't walk away from it. He just asks them once more, now, whom seek ye? And I bet they said a whole lot more cautiously, Jesus of Nazareth, and braced themselves. And Jesus said, I have told you that I am he. Therefore, you seek me. Let these go. If you want me, here I am. Let my disciples go. Well, at this time, as he said that, it was that it might fulfill that which was spoken, the prophecy given, of them which thou gavest me have I lost none. I'm watching out for my disciples. I'm not losing them. So Jesus said, let these go, and indeed they scattered at that point, except Peter. Peter, who had a sword, verse 10, drew it, and he smote the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Ah, precious Peter. I like this guy. Don't be too hard on him. He is a man's man. You recall how the disciples all said, we'll go to Jerusalem with you and die. Well, Peter here is going on record, standing up for what was said, and he's ready to. He takes his little sword. How did he get a sword? Remember the story? Jesus there at the end of his ministry said, hey, times are changing. Go out and buy yourself a sword. Get ready. He used that as an idiom, as a phrase. In other words, there's going to be hostility in tough times. But Peter took it literally. And he goes out and buys a sword. He misses the point of what Jesus was saying. Peter went out and had one. Okay, I got it. And here's this guy, Peter. I love him. Great guy. A man's man, ready to take on 600 Roman soldiers. And he raises up that sword and lets it fly, and he hits the high priest's servant, a man named Malchus. And he missed, and off came his ear onto the ground. Dr. Luke tells us in his gospel that at that point Jesus reached down, picked it up, and fixed it back on Malchus's head. Lend me your ears. Really, had Jesus not healed Malchus's ear, there could have well been four crosses on that hill called Calvary a few hours later. Peter could have been crucified right there for that. But Jesus does something. Jesus, the last miracle that he did before his crucifixion was healing somebody that one of his disciples hurt. Unnecessarily, needlessly, one of his disciples hurt. How? With the sword flying indiscriminately. The last miracle that Jesus did was to heal a hurt that was caused by one of his right-hand men who was filleting the sword indiscriminately and inappropriately. I still think that many times those of us who are his disciples are hurting people unnecessarily as we are whipping out the scriptures, the sword. For the word of God, what is quick and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword. And sometimes in our zeal, like Peter, I gotta stand up for you, Lord. Others are carnal or weak, but man, Lord, you can count on me, sweet Pete. And I'll stand up for you, Lord. And I'll let the sword fly and boom, We cause pain and hurts sometimes that are inappropriate and not right. In our zeal, like Peter, it's zeal without knowledge. What went wrong here? Peter is zealous, for that we applaud him, but it's not according to knowledge about what's happening. Why did he not have knowledge about what was happening? Why didn't he see it clearly that this was going according to pattern? Because Jesus invited Peter to watch and pray. But what did Peter do? He fell asleep. And now he wakes up and he's groggy and he's sleepy and he sees an army, he sees a battle, and he whips out his sword and boom! And Jesus looks at Peter and says, "Put up your sword. Peter, put away your sword." You see, you and I, truly, we're not praying the way that we should at all. And then we see a potential skirmish or battle, and we think, the answer is, let him have it. We've been sleeping and not praying, and so in our zeal, thinking that we're standing up for Christ, we whip out our swords and let them fly, and blood flows and people are hurt. Put away your sword, Peter, and watch what Jesus here says. He says, "The cup which my Father has given me, shall I not drink it?" You know, gang, you can't hold an unsheathed sword that's going to cause pain and the cup at the same time. That's the key for me. I realize, Lord, that my unsheathed sword, my zeal without knowledge, or my knowledge of the word apart from your Spirit, can cause people to be hurt. I need to hold on to the cup. I really believe that if Bible students and Bible professors and seminary teachers and zealous Christians of all sorts would come to the Lord's table more frequently and hold the cup of suffering and see the communion of the Christian community, the oneness in Christ and the price that was paid for the sins which we are so offended by. I believe that if we would take more seriously, do this often in remembrance of me, if we would hold the cup, we would put away the sword. Here you see Peter chopping away, and here you see Jesus saying, "Hey, the cup, what's in your hand? A sword that's causing pain, or a cup of suffering that brings humility and unity in the body of Christ?" Put away your sword, Peter. "The cup which my Father has given me, shall I not drink it?" Then the band and the captain and officers of the Jews took Jesus and they bound him. Whether that be with ropes or chains, we don't know. But the fact is, whether it be ropes or chains, that was not what bound him. Not those chains, not that rope. He was bound by his love for me. He was going to the cross willingly. He had embraced the cup of suffering that he spoke of previously. And it was love that kept him on that path. Not their chains, not those ropes, not the soldiers. Truly, it was love. And now he's being led away. First they take him, verse 13 tells us, to Annas's house. For he was the father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was the high priest that same year. Brought to the house of Annas. Annas was the power broker in Jerusalem. He was the high priest from the year 5 AD to 16 AD. About 11 years he served as the high priest, but he gave up the priesthood because he had some business concessions that needed his full attention. Those concessions were the selling of cows and sheep and doves on the Temple Mount. Recall the story? How that those guys selling cows and sheep and dove were ripping off the people. The people would come to Jerusalem to worship, but you see, if there was a blemish found on the cow or a mark on the bird or some kind of mar on the lamb, the priests inspecting these would say, hey, you can't offer this to God. Unacceptable. But what a deal. We have right over here cows and doves and sheep for sale. And they were selling them at exorbitant rates. High prices. And guess who owned the concessions? Annas. He was becoming a multi-millionaire in this economy. Because he was selling all of these cows and sheep and birds. Now when Jesus begins his public ministry, what does he do? He goes into the temple and he overturns the money changers that were also part of Annas' thing and drives out the cattle and the sheep and tells them, get those doves out of here. Annas was not a happy camper. He realized that Jesus was threatening his business. I think every evangelist and current Christian ministry should carefully study and think through the story of Jesus in the temple. Selling their stuff. Raising money that's not really in accordance with the heart of the Father. And Jesus went in there, realized that all of these concessions were hindering people from getting close to God. They were barricading people who came just to worship and know the Lord. All this stuff was getting in the way, and it was a barrier in front of them, and Jesus just ripped right into them. Annas was ticked. Annas, of course, resigned from his high priestly ministry in order to concentrate on the business ends, but you see, he had five sons, and these five sons and sons-in-law continued on serving as high priests, but Annas was the power behind the throne. And here, they take him to Annas first. Then, Caiaphas. Caiaphas was the son-in-law of Annas. And this is the same Caiaphas that said in verse 14, it was expedient that one man should die for the people. He didn't know he was prophesying. He didn't know what he was saying, but he was speaking truth, that one man must die for our salvation. So as he's brought into the house of Annas, Simon Peter, verse 15, followed Jesus. Matthew tells us he followed Jesus afar off. I like Peter because you see, he is following Jesus. Others were scattered and hiding besides John. But at the same time, I learned from Peter that if I follow Jesus from a distance, I'm going to get in trouble. Jesus would later on say, I wish that you were either hot or cold. Either, man, get close, stay tight, or be cold. But I don't want you lukewarm. If you are lukewarm, I will spew you out of my mouth. Stay tight. It's not always easy. And here Peter, you see, was feeling perhaps maybe rebuked a bit by being told to put away his sword. Maybe he felt bad about Malchus's ear on the ground that Jesus had to pick up and put it back on. But Peter here was following from afar off at a distance. And another disciple also followed Jesus. Verse 15 tells us, that disciple was known unto the high priest and went in with Jesus into the palace of the high priest. But Peter stood at the door outside. Then went out that other disciple, which was known to the high priest, and spake unto her that kept the door, and brought in Peter. The other disciple is John. Interesting, we are told that he was known by the high priest. If you go with us to Jerusalem, we'll show you a spot that historically, traditionally, is called Zebedee's fish stand. Zebedee was John's father, who was a very successful fisherman. He had boats, servants. The guy was really quite a successful entrepreneur. It would seem as though, according to history and tradition, that this is how John knew the high priest. For they, Zebedee and the boys, would fish in the Sea of Galilee up north. Not having refrigeration in those days, they would then take the fish that was caught and salt much of it. Bring the salted fish that was being preserved by that salt down to Jerusalem and sell it there, where it was considered a real delicacy to eat the fish from the Sea of Galilee. And those particular fish being brought down from Galilee were really, it was kind of like caviar. It was a high price kind of good. And it just so happens that, according to tradition and history, that the priestly family that was making all this money from ripping off the people, these multimillionaires, they could afford to eat this fish and would go to Zebedee's little fish shop. And John was the son of Zebedee who came down and would frequently sell the fish in that. It's very feasible, very possible that that tradition is true. That's how John did know the high priest and could go in and talk with the high priest. Because he was selling, as a young boy or a young teenager, he was selling to the high priest fish. Some people think that story is fishy and don't buy it. That's fine. But it's very possible. Be that as it may, this disciple John did know the high priest. Was going in and watching and observing, then went out and told Peter to come in as well. But the damsel that kept the door, verse 17, said unto Peter, "Are not you one of this man's disciples?" And he said, "I am not." Ooh, Pete. That's what happens when you follow Jesus afar off. "Aren't you one of his disciples?" "No." And the servants, verse 18, and the officers stood there who had made a fire of coals because it was cold. And they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with them and warmed himself. Uh-oh, Peter. Not only are you following Jesus afar off, but now you're warming yourself at the fires of Jesus' enemies. When you feel bad, where do you go get warmed up at? Again, if we warm ourselves where the world warms themselves, if you go to the fires of the world to get warm when you're confused or hurting or lonely, if that's where you go, to the fires of the world, you're gonna get burned. Ask Peter. He warms himself by the fires of the Lord's enemies. He warmed himself there. The high priest, verse 19, then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. Now, this was illegal. The Jewish law had a stipulation much like our Fifth Amendment, in which it was considered illegal to ask a person that was on trial, being questioned, about the charges or about anything that might implicate him. We have that in our Constitution, in our legal system. You plead the Fifth. So right away here, this begins already the illegality of the trial of Jesus here before these religious leaders. He is out of order here, the high priest, in asking Jesus of his doctrine. So Jesus says, I spoke openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple where the Jews always resort. And in secret have I said nothing. Why askest thou me? Ask them which heard me what I have said. Behold, they know what I have said. In other words, why are you asking me? Ask other witnesses. And in so saying, he was reminding the high priest that, hey, what you're doing is illegal. Ask witnesses. I spoke openly. I said nothing secretly. Bring in witnesses. But this would definitely be a reminder of the illegality of the very trial that was taking place. So when he had thus spoken, verse 22, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, Answerest thou the high priest so? This officer knew what Jesus was saying. It was insulting to remind the high priest of his violating the law. Boom! How dare you talk to the high priest that way? And Jesus said, If I have spoken evil, bear witness. Bring forth witnesses of that evil. But if I have spoken well, why smitest thou me? Now Annas had sent him bound unto Caiaphas, the high priest. From the house of Annas, he now goes to the house of Caiaphas. Keep in mind that during this religious trial, first at the house of Annas and then at the house of Caiaphas, who was the acting high priest? Annas was the power behind the throne. That Jesus' suffering really begins happening intensively. You see, there in the courtyard of the high priest, we are told that they put a bag over his head or blinded his eyes. And they began to mock him and taunt him. And they began to strike him and say, Prophesy, if thou be the Son of God. As they would punch him in the face, they would challenge him to prophesy. That is, tell us who hit you. If you are who you're claiming to be. Boom! Now, the human body is made in kind of an interesting way. When someone's about to strike you, usually you can catch it out of the corner of your eye. And so although you might receive the blow, you're already kind of going with it. But when you're blindsided, if you truly do not see the punch coming, you're in trouble. You're going to get really hurt badly. These NFL quarterbacks that drop back and throw the ball and then are wiped out, you know, and you think, man, what a blow, and they pop right back up again. It's because they see it coming. And even though they absorb the blow, they're falling with it. They're going with the flow. But it's when you do not see it coming at all, that's when there is excruciating pain and physical danger. What happened here in the courtyard of the high priest when they began to smite him? He could not see the blows coming. It would be exceedingly painful. Permanently damaging would it be if you, if me, if we were to receive that kind of hitting, that kind of blow. And Jesus, we are told in Isaiah, because of the beginning of these beatings and the going on through his sufferings, was marred more than any other man, Isaiah 52 tells us. Beyond recognition. And here already the suffering is intensifying as these religious guards there in the courtyard of the high priest begin to beat him and hit him, strike him. Well, he sent there to the house of Caiaphas, and Simon Peter stood and warmed himself, and they said therefore unto him, Art not thou one of his disciples? And he denied it and said, I am not. One of the servants of the high priest, being his kinsman, whose ear Peter cut off, Did not I see thee in the garden with him? Peter then denied again, verse 27, and immediately the cock crew. Peter, following Jesus afar off, warming himself at the wrong fires, ends up doing exactly what Jesus said would happen. When you hear the cock crow, Peter, you'll have denied me three times. Keep in mind that when this cock crew, when the rooster sounded, it would be a very penetrating, very certain kind of sound. For you see, roosters were outlawed from the city of Jerusalem during the holy festivals. Why? Because they left messes. Appropriate that Jesus would say, you're going to hear the cock crow because you're, Peter, going to mess up. And that sound is going to stand out in your ears. It's because you're going to mess up, Peter. You're going to deny me. Peter said, Lord, even if everybody else denies you or leaves you, I never will. He was cock sure of himself. And here the movie begins to happen as he denies the Lord once, twice, three times. Cocky one and cocky two and cocky three. He thinks that he's really something, but in reality, Jesus said, hey, Peter, you're going to end up denying me. And when you hear the cock crow, man, the rooster sounding, you who were so sure of yourself, Peter, you got to learn an important lesson that your own strength is insufficient for the temptations. You're not as strong as you think you are, and neither am I or you. Let he who thinks he stands, what? Take heed lest he fall. Now, this is sad for sure. But I suggest to you there's a real bright side to this equation. For you see, what does a rooster crowing signify? When a rooster crows, it signifies a new day is dawning. Yes, Peter, you've blown it. Yes, you've cursed and sworn and said, I don't know him, not once, but thrice. And the rooster sounds. Peter, you've messed up. Peter, you've blown it, but a new day is dawning. I'm not through with you, not by a long shot. In fact, when Jesus was resurrected, he went and sought out Peter individually, specifically. He dealt with Peter in chapter 21, as we shall soon see. He commissioned Peter back into ministry, and on the day of Pentecost, 10 days after Jesus had ascended up into heaven, it was Peter who stood up and preached the word, and 3,000 were saved that day. Peter became a real leader, the prominent apostle there in Jerusalem. I tell you this because you need to know that wherever Peter went, church history tells us that there would always be those that would show up and make fun of him by crowing, whenever he would be teaching, there'd be those that would come and go, cock-a-doodle-doo. Many times, until the day he died, we are told by Eusebius and church historians that Peter would be taunted and mocked about his failure by people who would come and pretend like they were imitating the rooster. Sad. Didn't stop Peter. He kept preaching, kept serving. Powerful apostle, a great man. Sad to me when believers do not give each other a fresh start, a new day. When we hold grudges or keep scores or remind others of previous failure, it ought not to be. We ought to always be looking for opportunities to see women, to see men continue on, to be restored, to not be held back because of a failure. In Galatians 6, verse 1, it says, "Brethren, if any of you be overtaken in a fault, you who are spiritual, restore such a one." Restore doesn't mean remind or rebuke or reveal. It means restore. "You who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted." Always look for opportunity to restore people. Not to remind them, to restore them, not to rebuke them, to restore them, not to reveal, to restore. That's the ministry of reconciliation. Aren't you glad our God is the God of the second chance and the 10th chance and the 880th chance? I am. And so the cock crew, reminding Peter of his failure, but signaling as well a new day was dawning. "Peter, it's not over. It's not over." They led Jesus from Caiaphas, verse 28, unto the hall of judgment before Pontius Pilate. It was early. They themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, so that they might eat of the Passover. Incredible. We don't want to defile ourselves by going into the hall of judgment where this Gentile Pontius Pilate is. We'll become defiled. Here they are, killing the Son of God. And they're worrying about stepping on Gentile territory. Jesus said, it's crazy how people will strain at gnats. There's a gnat here in the soup. We'll strain out the gnat. We'll watch out for the gnat. And he says they swallow camels. Great picture. A guy with a bowl of soup picking out the gnat, and his spoon is a huge camel, and he's crazy. And yet we do that in religious circles, in churches, in religiosity. We are so careful about certain things and we miss the big picture altogether. And they didn't want to go in because, you see, they would become defiled from eating the Passover. But here they are plotting and planning to crucify Christ. Pilate then went out unto them. They wouldn't come in, so Pilate went out. And Pilate said, "What accusation bring you against this man?" What's going on here? Keep in mind, Pontius Pilate was in trouble politically at this time. He was a procurator, a Roman procurator. When Herod the Great, who was a powerful man and a brilliant builder, when he died, his three sons became tetrarchs, or they became ruling over certain areas in Israel. And Herod Archelaus became the ruler over the area that Jerusalem was in. And he was a lousy ruler. And so the Jews appealed to Rome, "Send us somebody to help us out. this guy that we have is a lousy ruler. So they, in Rome, sent Pontius Pilate, who was previously a slave, and through marrying up and through some political maneuvering, found himself being sent by Rome as the leader there, the procurator, the overseer. But when he got there, Pilate made a couple of big goofs. This Pilate really crashed. He goes into Jerusalem. Living in Caesarea up on the coast, a beautiful spot, that's where he lived. But occasionally he would come into Jerusalem, particularly for the big feasts. And the first time he came in, he brought with him his soldiers who were carrying on their flag stands or poles. There was a bust of Emperor, the head of the Emperor. And when Pilate's soldiers came into Jerusalem and into that temple area carrying those busts, those little images of the emperor's head, it was considered idolatry by the Jews. They brought an idol because the emperor was worshipped as God, and this caused a riot. And the people rioted against Pontius Pilate, and they followed him all the way back up into Caesarea, and they went before him in his palatial area rioting, and finally Pilate allowed things to get out of control and blood was shed. And Rome sent a warning to Pontius Pilate saying, "Hey man, get it together. We don't want this kind of ruckus." So Pontius thought, "Well, I can help the people out here by building them an aqueduct. There's a lot of need for water." So he went into the temple and took the money that was in the temple treasury to build this aqueduct. Crazy. The people got really ticked off again. Rome heard about it, and Rome issued yet another warning saying essentially, "You got two strikes against you, Pontius. One more and you're out." So Pilate here is on the political hot seat already. He doesn't want another ruckus to happen. And now the Jews are gathering in this area and there's a problem happening. And he says, "Well, what's the problem here? What accusation do you bring against this man?" And they said, "If he were not a malefactor, we would not have delivered him up to thee. If he wasn't a criminal, we wouldn't have brought him here." Pilate said, "Take ye him and judge him according to your law." The Jews therefore said, "It is not lawful for us to put any man to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke concerning the death that he would die." He had to die, you see, not according to the Jewish form of capital punishment, which is stoning, but the Roman form of capital punishment, which is what? Crucifixion. Crucifixion invented by the Iranians, the Persians. You see, the Persians believed that the land, the soil, was holy. So if they were going to execute a person, they would lift him off of the ground and pin him to a pole or to a cross. He would die on that cross, and they would leave his body there on the cross until the vultures came and just picked him clean. It was a very terrible way to die. Invented by the Persians, picked up by the Grecians, further developed by the Romans, these succeeding empires. And Jesus had to die on the cross to fulfill all the prophecies that were given so exactingly. Psalm 22, Isaiah 53. It was essential that he die on the cross, not a according to the Jewish custom, but he, for you history students of Bible times, did you realize that the Jews lost the right of capital punishment in the year AD 30, 2 years before this time? The Romans came in and said, "You will no longer have the right to stone, to kill." This caused a great deal of turmoil in the Jewish community because, you see, the rite of capital punishment is sort of the foundation of governmental authority. And so the Jewish rabbis, many of them in the year AD 30, when the Romans took away the right to execute their own, the Jews could no longer administer capital punishment. What happened was these rabbis ripped their clothes and they put on sackcloth. They threw dirt over their heads and they said, God has failed us. God has failed us. As they marched through the streets of Jerusalem, God has failed us. Why? Because in the book of Genesis, the promise was given, and the scepter speaks of authority, government, ruling. It says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah until Shiloh or Messiah comes. And they were saying, God has failed us. The scepter has been taken from us. The basic foundational point of government, that is dealing with criminals according to our, it's been taken from us. And Messiah's not here. Yes, he was. He was right in their midst. A fascinating convergence of history with prophecy. And they didn't see it. They thought, God has failed us. We've lost the scepter and Messiah's not here. Yes, he was. In that very year, he was preaching right in the midst of them. But they didn't understand. And all this was working out that the scriptures might be fulfilled. You do it, they said. It's not lawful that we should put a man to death. Remember that? We lost that right 2 years ago. Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and called Jesus and said, Art thou the King of the Jews? And Jesus said, Sayest thou this thing of thyself, or did others tell it of thee? Do you want to know really? Or are you just repeating what you've heard? Do you really want to know? A lot of times people ask us questions and they really don't want to know the answer. They want to argue. Well, did Adam have a belly button or not? Where did Cain get his wife? Can God make a rock so big he can't lift it? And you know, these questions are hurled at us, and it's not because people want an answer, they want to argue. And really, you would be wise to continue to learn whether people are asking for answers or asking to argue. And if they're asking to argue, don't cast your pearls before swine. You'll just get engaged in endless hours of argumentation that will get you nowhere. So Jesus here is asking that. Are you really asking? Or are you just repeating what others told you concerning me? Pilate said, Am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priests have delivered you unto me. What have you done? Jesus said, My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence. My kingdom ain't here. Art thou a king? Jesus answered, You said it. You said it, Pilate. Thou sayest that I am a king. That's right. You got it. To this end was I born. For this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness of the truth. Everyone that is of the truth hears my voice. That's a promise. Everybody who really wants to know the truth, no matter where they live, no matter when they live, every person, Jesus said, who wants to know the truth will hear his voice. God's not fair, choosing some and not choosing others. Jesus said, everyone who wants to know the truth will hear his voice. Pilate responds by saying, well, what is truth? And then he doesn't even stick around to hear what Jesus might have to say. Well, what is truth? And when he had said that, he went out again to the Jews and said, I find no fault in him at all. I don't find any fault in him. But the crowd, of course, would not be satisfied. At this point, the other Gospels tell us they began to interrupt and yell out at Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate, knowing that there was no fault in this one in whom he was questioning. Pontius Pilate now hopes to appease the crowd by saying, you have a custom that I should release unto you one at the Passover. Will you therefore I release unto you the King of the Jews? They cried, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a robber. Barabbas, a murderer and an insurrectionist. Barabbas means son of the father. We are told historically that his name, first name, was Yeshua, Jesus. Jesus, son of the Father. Who do you want released? Barabbas, Bar Abbas, son of the Father, Yeshua Barabbas, or Yeshua Christos, Yeshua Mashiach, Jesus Christ. Interesting irony happening here. Who do you want released? A murderer or the master? An insurrectionist or a resurrectionist? Who do you want released? And we'll pick up the story from there in our study next week. One closing comment. Barabbas, of course, will be set free. This murderer, this insurrectionist, this despicable personality. He is set free because Jesus would go to the cross in the place of Barabbas. And Jesus went to the cross in place of me. So tonight, you are listening to one and looking at one who has been set free. Oh, you're a murderer. You're an insurrectionist. You're a loser. Right. Who did he kill? Jesus said, if you've ever been angry with your brother, you're really guilty of murder. Who here has not been angry with a brother? An insurrectionist. Who here has not caused division, problems, trouble in some way with someone at some time? We're all a bunch of sinners. Like Peter, we have heard the cock crow loudly. But good news. Jesus Christ really, truly, truly went through this in place of you, in place of me. I'm real glad he did. Because now we're free. We are set free. There is no condemnation. There is no record being kept. We come to this place tonight simply to bask in God's grace and express our appreciation for the fact that we go free. Because he was carried away with cords of love, really, to die for me, for you. And I'm real thankful. Last night, Benjamin comes running into our room. Mommy, Daddy. Benjamin, he's my 4-year-old. Great guy. Benjamin comes in and says, Mommy, Daddy, as he's holding his little figure of Jesus that he got in the bookstore. Mary, she grabbed my Jesus and I told her to give Jesus back to me. And she said, okay, you can have your stupid Jesus. She said that. Mary comes running in. I didn't mean that. And she just starts crying. Am I going to go to hell? And she just wailed. And I grabbed her. Oh, Mary, you're not going to go to hell. And neither are you. But John, you don't know how I failed him. You're forgiven. Really. Maybe, but I'll never be used. There's a bunch of roosters always following me. They're always crowing and reminding me of my failing. Hey. And I don't mean to be cute. I hope you remember this. Don't peter out. Because the Lord is not going to give up on you. That's an absolute fact. He died for your sins. He went to the cross in place of you, even if you said some stupid things like my little Mary did, accidentally or intentionally. Even if you've messed up like Peter did there in Jerusalem, you see. Please understand. You're forgiven. You go free because he took the cross. Please live in that fact. Don't give up. Don't pull back. Don't turn away and say, I can't because I blew it. Go on. A new day is dawning. Truly. Honestly. Go on. Keep going. And help others to do the same. Would you? Would you look for people that are just sidelined, that have given up, that are wiped out, that have pulled back because they feel like they've erred, they failed? Would you throw your arm around them? Would you write that letter to them? Would you, if possible, open up a way for them? To let them go on. Because that's the way of our Lord. It really is. I believe the Lord wants the Applegate Christian Fellowship to be a place where people are restored and reconciled. Not reminded, not rebuked. But restored. Don't you think that's what the Lord has for us? May it be true, truly. For us and through us. In the name of Jesus. Shall we stand?